Side 12, Unfinished Tales of Numenor and Middle-earth, by J.R.R. Tolkien. Continuing with The Quest of Erebor, on page 332. Editor, these uncles were Hildefons Took, who went off on a journey and never returned, and Isengard Took, the youngest of the old Took's 12 children, who was said to have gone to sea in his youth. The Lord of the Rings, Appendix C. Family Tree of Took of Great Smiles. When Gandalf accepted Thorin's invitation to go with him to his home in the Blue Mountains. Author. We actually passed through the Shire, though Thorin would not stop long enough for that to be useful. Indeed, I think it was annoyance with his haughty disregard of the hobbits that first put into my head the idea of entangling him with them. As far as he was concerned, they were just food growers who happened to work the fields on either side of the dwarves' ancestral road to the mountains. Editor. In this earlier version, Gandalf gave a long account of how, after his visit to the Shire, he returned to Thorin and persuaded him to put aside his lofty designs and go secretly and take Bilbo with him. Which sentence is all that is said of it in the later version, page 323. Author. At last I made up my mind and I went back to Thorin. I found him in conclave with some of his kinsfolk. Balin and Glóin were there, and several others. Well, what have you got to say? Thorin asked me as soon as I came in. This first, I answered. Your own ideas are those of a king, Thorin Oakenshield, but your kingdom is gone. If it is to be restored, which I doubt, it must be from small beginnings. Far away here, I wonder if you fully realize the strength of a great dragon. But that is not all. There is a shadow growing fast in the world, far more terrible. They will help one another. And they certainly would have done so if I had not attacked Dol Guldur at the same time. Open war would be quite useless, and anyway it is impossible for you to arrange it. You will have to try something simpler, and yet bolder. Indeed, something desperate. You are both vague and disquieting, said Thorin. Speak more plainly. Well, for one thing, I said, you will have to go on this quest yourself, and you will have to go secretly. No messengers, heralds, or challengers for you, Thorin Oakenshield. At most, you can take with you a few kinsmen or faithful followers, but you will need something more, something unexpected. Name it, said Thorin. One moment, I said. You hope to deal with a dragon, and he is not only very great, but he is now also old and very cunning. From the beginning of your adventure, you must allow for this, his memory and his sense of smell. Naturally, said Thorin, dwarves have had more dealings with dragons than most, and you are not instructing the ignorant. Very good, I answered, but your own plans did not seem to me to consider this point. My plan is one of stealth. Stealth. Footnote. At this point, a sentence in the manuscript A was perhaps unintentionally omitted in the typescript, in view of Gandalf's subsequent remark about Smaug's never having smelt a hobbit. Also a scent that cannot be placed, at least not by Smaug, the enemy of dwarves. End of footnote. Smaug does not lie on his costly bed without dreams, Thorin Oakenshield. He dreams of dwarves. You may be sure that he explores his hall day by day, night by night, until he is sure that no faintest air of a dwarf is near before he goes to his sleep, his half-sleep, prick-eared for the sound of dwarf feet. You make your stealth sound as difficult and hopeless as any open attack, said Balin. Impossibly difficult. Yes, it is difficult, I answered. But not impossibly difficult, or I would not waste my time here. I would say absurdly difficult. So I am going to suggest an absurd solution to the problem. Take a hobbit with you. Smaug has probably never heard of hobbits, and he has certainly never smelt them. What? Cried Glóin. One of those simpletons down in the Shire? What use on earth or under it could he possibly be? Let him smell as he may, he would never dare to come within smelling distance of the nakedest dragon net new from the shell. Now, I said, that is quite unfair. You do not know much about the Shire folk, Glóin. I suppose you think them simple because they are generous and do not haggle, and think them timid because you never sell them any weapons. You are mistaken. Anyway, there is one that I have my eye on as a companion for you, Thorin. He is neat-handed and clever, though shrewd, and far from rash. And I think he has courage. Great courage, I guess, according to the way of his people. They are, you might say, brave at a pinch. You have to put these hobbits in a tight place before you find out what is in them. The test cannot be made, Thorin answered. As far as I have observed, they do all that they can to avoid tight places. Quite true, I said. They are a very sensible people. But this hobbit is rather unusual. I think he could be persuaded to go into a tight place. I believe that in his heart he really desires to have, as he would put it, an adventure. Not at my expense, said Thorin, rising and striding about angrily. This is not advice. It is foolery. I fail to see what any hobbit, good or bad, could do that would repay me for a day's keep, even if he could be persuaded to start. Fail to see? You would fail to hear it, Mikely, I answered. Hobbits move without effort more quietly than any dwarf in the world could manage, though his life depended on it. They are, I suppose, the most soft-footed of all mortal kinds. You do not seem to have observed that, at any rate, Thorin Oakenshield, as you tramped through the Shire, making a noise, I may say, that the inhabitants could hear a mile away. When I said that you would need stealth, I meant it. Professional stealth. Professional stealth? Cried Balin, taking up my words rather differently than I had meant them. Do you mean a trained treasure seeker? Can they still be found? I hesitated. This was a new turn, and I was not sure how to take it. I think so, I said at last. For a reward, they will go in where you dare not, or at any rate cannot, and get what you desire. Thorin's eyes glistened as the memories of lost treasures moved in his mind. But a paid thief, you mean? He said scornfully. That might be considered, if the reward was not too high. But what is all this to do with one of those villagers? They drink out of clay, and they cannot tell a gem from a bead of glass. I wish you would not always speak so confidently without knowledge, I said sharply. These villagers have lived in the Shire some 1,400 years, and they have learned many things in the time. They had dealings with the elves and with the dwarves 1,000 years before Smaug came to Erebor. None of them are wealthy as your forefathers reckoned it, but you will find some of their dwellings have fairer things in them than you can boast here, Thorin. The hobbit that I have in mind has ornaments of gold, and eats with silver tools, and drinks wine out of shapely crystal. Ah, I see your drift at last, said Balin. He is a thief, then. That is why you recommend him? At that, I fear I lost my temper and my caution. This dwarvish conceit that no one can have or make anything of value save themselves, and that all fine things in other hands must have been got, if not stolen, from the dwarves at some time, was more than I could stand at that moment. A thief, I said, laughing. Why, yes, a professional thief, of course. How else would a hobbit come by a silver spoon? I will put the thief's mark on his door, and then you will find it. Then, being angry, I got up, and I said with a warmth that surprised myself, You must look for that door, Thorin Oakenshield. I am serious. And suddenly I felt that I was indeed in hot earnest. This queer notion of mine was not a joke. It was right. It was desperately important that it should be carried out. The dwarves must bend their stiff necks. Listen to me, Durin's folk, I cried. If you persuade this hobbit to join you, you will succeed. If you do not, you will fail. If he refuse even to try, then I have finished with you. You will get no more advice or help from me until the shadow falls on you. Thorin turned and looked at me in astonishment, as well he might. Strong words, he said. Very well, I will come. Some foresight is on you, if you are not merely crazed. Good, I said. But you must come with goodwill, not merely in the hope of proving me a fool. You must be patient, and not easily put off, if neither the courage nor the desire for adventure that I speak of are plain to see at first sight. He will deny them. He will try to back out. But you must not let him. Haggling will not help him, if that is what you mean, said Thorin. I will offer him a fair reward for anything that he recovers, and no more. It was not what I meant, but it seemed useless to say so. There is one other thing, I went on. You must make all your plans and preparations beforehand. Get everything ready. Once persuaded, you must have no time for second thoughts. You must go straight from the Shire east on your quest.
He sounds a very strange creature, this thief of yours, said a young dwarf called Fili,
Thorin's nephew, as I afterwards learned.
What is his name, or the one that he uses?
Hobbits use their real names, I said. The only one that he has is Bilbo Baggins.
What a name, said Fili, and laughed.
He thinks it very respectable, I said, and it fits well enough, for he is a middle-aged bachelor and getting a bit flabby and fat. Food is perhaps at present his main interest. He keeps a very good larder, I am told, and maybe more than one. At least you will be well entertained.
That is enough, said Thorin. If I had not given my word, I would not come now. I am in no mood to be made a fool of, for I am serious also, deadly serious, and my heart is hot within me.
I took no notice of this.
Look now, Thorin, I said, April is passing, and spring is here. Make everything ready as soon as you can. I have some business to do, but I shall be back in a week.
When I return, if all is in order, I will ride on ahead to prepare the ground. Then we will all visit him together on the following day. And with that, I took my leave, not wishing to give Thorin more chance of second thoughts than Bilbo was to have. The rest of the story is well known to you, from Bilbo's point of view. If I had written the account, it would have sounded rather different. He did not know all that went on. The care, for instance, that I took so that the coming of a large party of dwarves to Bywater, off the main road and their usual beat, should not come to his ears too soon. It was on the morning of Tuesday, April the 25th, 2941, that I called to see Bilbo, and though I knew more or less what to expect, I must say that my confidence was shaken. I saw that things would be far more difficult than I had thought, but I persevered. Next day, Wednesday, April the 26th, I brought Thorin and his companions to Bag End. With great difficulty, so far as Thorin was concerned, he hung back at the last. And, of course, Bilbo was completely bewildered and behaved ridiculously. Everything, in fact, went extremely badly for me from the beginning. And that unfortunate business about the professional thief, which the dwarves had got firmly into their heads, only made matters worse. I was thankful that I had told Thorin we should all stay the night at Bag End, since we should need time to discuss ways and means. It gave me a last chance. If Thorin had left Bag End before I could see him alone, my plan would have been ruined. Editor, it will be seen that some elements of this conversation were in the later version taken up into the argument between Gandalf and Thorin at Bag End. From this point, the narrative in the later version follows the earlier very closely, which is not therefore further cited here, except for a passage at the end. In the earlier, when Gandalf ceased speaking, Frodo records that Gimli laughed. Author,
it still sounds absurd, he said, even now that all has turned out more than well. I knew Thorin, of course, and I wish I had been there, but I was away at the time of your first visit to us, and I was not allowed to go on the quest. Too young, they said, though at 62 I thought myself fit for anything. Well, I am glad to have heard the full tale, if it is full. I do not really suppose that even now you are telling us all you know.
Of course not, said Gandalf. Editor. And after this, Merry Adoc questioned Gandalf further about Thrain's map and key, and in the course of his reply, most of which is retained in the later version at a different point in the narrative, Gandalf said, Author, it was 9 years after Thrain had left his people that I found him, and he had then been in the pits of Dol Guldur for 5 years at least. I do not know how he endured so long, nor how he had kept these things hidden through all his torments. I think that the Dark Power had desired nothing from him except the ring only, and when he had taken that, he troubled no further, but just flung the broken prisoner into the pits to rave until he died. A small oversight, but it proved fatal. Small oversights often do.
4. The Hunt for the Ring. 1. Of the Journey of the Black Riders, according to the account that Gandalf gave to Frodo. Gollum was captured in Mordor in the year 3017 and taken to Barad-dûr, and there questioned and tormented. When he had learned what he could from him, Sauron released him and sent him forth again. He did not trust Gollum, for he divined something indomitable in him, which could not be overcome, even by the shadow of fear, except by destroying him. But Sauron perceived the depth of Gollum's malice towards those that had robbed him, and guessing that he would go in search of them to avenge himself, Sauron hoped that his spies would thus be led to the ring. Gollum, however, was before long captured by Aragorn and taken to northern Mirkwood, and though he was followed, he could not be rescued before he was in safe keeping. Now Sauron had never paid heed to the halflings, even if he had heard of them, and he did not yet know where their land lay. From Gollum, even under pain, he could not get any clear account, both because Gollum indeed had no certain knowledge himself, and because what he knew he falsified. Ultimately indomitable he was, except by death, as Sauron guessed, both from his halfling nature, and from a cause which Sauron did not fully comprehend, being himself consumed by lust for the ring. Then he became filled with a hatred of Sauron, even greater than his terror, seeing in him truly his greatest enemy and rival. Thus it was that he dared to pretend that he believed that the land of the halflings was near to the places where he had once dwelt beside the banks of the Gladden. Now Sauron, learning of the capture of Gollum by the chiefs of his enemies, was in great haste and fear. Yet all his ordinary spies and emissaries could bring him no tidings. And this was due largely both to the vigilance of the Dúnedain and to the treachery of Saruman, whose own servants either waylaid or misled the servants of Sauron. Of this Sauron became aware, but his arm was not yet long enough to reach Saruman in Isengard. Therefore he hid his knowledge of Saruman's double-dealing and concealed his wrath, biding his time and preparing for the great war in which he planned to sweep all his enemies into the Western Sea. At length he resolved that no others would serve him in this case but his mightiest servants, the Ringwraiths, who had no will but his own, being each utterly subservient to the ring that had enslaved him, which Sauron held. Now few could withstand even one of these fell creatures, and as Sauron deemed, none could withstand them when gathered together under their terrible captain, the Lord of Morgul. Yet this weakness they had for Sauron's present purpose. So great was the terror that went with them, even invisible and unclad, that their coming forth might soon be perceived, and their mission be guessed by the wise. So it was that Sauron prepared two strokes, in which many after saw the beginnings of the War of the Ring. They were made together. The orcs assailed the realm of Thranduil with orders to recapture Gollum, and the Lord of Morgul was sent forth openly to battle against Gondor. These things were done towards the end of June 3018. Thus Sauron tested the strength and preparedness of Denethor, and found them more than he had hoped. But that troubled him little, since he had used little force in the assault, and his chief purpose was that the coming forth of the Nazgûl should appear only as part of his policy of war against Gondor. Therefore, when Osgiliath was taken, and the bridge broken, Sauron stayed the assault, and the Nazgûl were ordered to begin the search for the ring. But Sauron did not underestimate the powers and vigilance of the wise, and the Nazgûl were commanded to act as secretly as they could. Now at that time the chieftain of the Ringwraiths dwelt in Minas Morgul with six companions, while the second to the chief, Camul, the Shadow of the East, abode in Dol Guldur as Sauron's lieutenant, with one other as his messenger. Note 1. According to the entry in the Tale of Years for 2951, Sauron sent three, not two, of the Nazgûl to reoccupy Dol Guldur. The two statements can be reconciled on the assumption that one of the Ringwraiths of Dol Guldur returned afterwards to Minas Morgul, but I think it more likely that the formulation of the present text was superseded when the Tale of Years was compiled. And it may be noted that in a rejected version of the present passage, there was only one Nazgûl in Dol Guldur, not named as Camul, but referred to as the second chief, the Black Easterling, while one remained with Sauron as his chief messenger. From notes recounting in detail the movements of the Black Riders in the Shire, it emerges that it was Camul who came to Hobbiton and spoke to Gaffer Gamgee, who followed the hobbits along the road to Stalk, and who narrowly missed them at the Buckleberry Ferry. See page 344. The rider who accompanied him, whom he summoned by cries on the ridge above Woodhall, and with whom he visited Farmer Maggot, was his companion from Dol Guldur. Of Carmul, it is said here that he was the most ready of all the Nazgul, after the Black Captain himself, to perceive the presence of the ring, but also the one whose power was most confused and diminished by daylight. End of note. The Lord of Morgul therefore led his companions over Anduin unclad and unmounted, and invisible to eyes, and yet a terror to all living things that they passed near. It was, maybe, on the first day of July that they went forth. They passed slowly and in stealth through Anorion and over the Entwade, and so into the Wold. And rumor of darkness and a dread of men knew not what went before them. They reached the west shores of Anduin, a little north of Sarngebir, as they had trysted, and there received horses and raiment that were secretly ferried over the river. This was, it is thought, about the 17th of July. Then they passed northward, seeking for the Shire, the land of the halflings. About the 22nd of July they met their companions, the Nazgul of Dol Guldur, in the field of Celebrant. There they learned that Gollum had eluded both the orcs that recaptured him and the elves that pursued them, and had vanished. Note 2. He had, indeed, in his terror of the Nazgul, dared to hide in Moria. Author's note. End of note. They were told also by Carmul that no dwelling of halflings could be discovered in the vales of Anduin, and that the villages of the Stores by the Gladden had long been deserted. But the Lord of Morgul, seeing no better counsel, determined still to seek northward, hoping maybe to come upon Gollum as well as to discover the Shire. That this would prove to be not far from the hated land of Lorien seemed to him not unlikely, if it was not indeed within the fences of Galadriel. But the power of the White Ring he would not defy, nor enter yet into Lorien. Passing therefore between Lorien and the mountains, the nine rode ever on into the north, and terror went before them and lingered behind them. But they did not find what they sought, nor learn any news that availed them. At length they returned, but the summer was now far waned, and the wrath and fear of Sauron was mounting. When they came back to the Wold, September had come, and there they met messengers from Barad Dûr, conveying threats from their master that filled even the Morgul lord with dismay. For Sauron had now learned of the words of prophecy heard in Gondor, and the going forth of Boromir, of Saruman's deeds, and the capture of Gandalf. From these things he concluded indeed that neither Saruman nor any other of the wise had possession yet of the ring, but that Saruman at least knew where it might be hidden. Speed alone would now serve, and secrecy must be abandoned. The ringwraiths therefore were ordered to go straight to Isengard. They rode them through Rohan in haste, and the terror of their passing was so great that many folk fled from the land and went wildly away north and west, believing that war out of the east was coming on the heels of the black horses. 2 days after Gandalf had departed from Orthanc, the Lord of Morgul halted before the gate of Isengard. Then Saruman, already filled with wrath and fear by the escape of Gandalf, perceived the peril of standing between enemies, a known traitor to both. His dread was great, for his hope of deceiving Sauron, or at the least of receiving his favor in victory, was utterly lost. Now either he himself must gain the ring, or come to ruin and torment. But he was wary and cunning still, and he had ordered Isengard against just such an evil chance. The circle of Isengard was too strong for even the Lord of Morgul and his company to assail without great force of war. Therefore, to his challenge and demands, he received only the answer of the voice of Saruman, that spoke by some art, as though it came from the gate itself. "It is not a land that you look for," it said. "I know what you seek, though you do not name it. I have it not, as surely its servants perceive without telling. For if I had it, then you would bow before me and call me Lord. And if I knew where this thing was hid, I should not be here, but long gone before you to take it. There is one only whom I guess to have this knowledge. Mithrandir, enemy of Sauron. And since it is but 2 days since he departed from Isengard, seek him nearby." Such was still the power of the voice of Saruman that even the Lord of the Nazgul did not question what it said, whether it was false or short of the full truth. But straightway he rode from the gate and began to hunt for Gandalf in Rohan. Thus it was that on the evening of the next day the Black Riders came upon Grima Wormtongue as he hastened to bring word to Saruman that Gandalf was come to Edoras and had warned King Theoden of the treacherous designs of Isengard. In that hour the Wormtongue came near to death by terror, but being inured to treachery, he would have told all that he knew under less threat.
Yea, verily I can tell you, Lord, he said. I have overheard their speech together in Isengard, the land of the halflings. It was thence that Gandalf came, and desires to return. He seeks now only a horse. Spare me, I speak as swiftly as I may. West through the gap of Rohan yonder, and then north and a little west, until the next great river bars the way. The Greyflood, it is called. Thence from the crossing at Tharbad, the old road will lead you to the borders. The Shire, they call it. Yea, verily, Saruman knows of it. Goods came to him from that land down the road. Spare me, Lord. Indeed, I will say naught of our meeting to any that live.
The Lord of the Nazgul spared the life of the Wormtongue, not out of pity, but because he deemed that so great a terror was upon him that he would never dare to speak of their encounter, as proved true, and he saw that the creature was evil and was likely to do great harm yet to Saruman, if he lived. So he left him lying on the ground and rode away, and did not trouble to go back to Isengard. Sauron's vengeance could wait. Now he divided his company into four pairs, and they rode separately, but he himself went ahead with the swiftest pair. Thus they passed west out of Rohan, and explored the desolation of Enedwaith, and came at last to Tharbad. Thence they rode through Menhirioth, and even though they were not yet assembled, a rumor of dread spread about them, and the creatures of the wild hid themselves, and lonely men fled away. But some fugitives on the road they captured, and to the delight of the captain, two proved to be spies and servants of Saruman. One of them had been used much in the traffic between Isengard and the Shire, and though he had not himself been beyond the South Farthing, he had charts prepared by Saruman, which clearly depicted and described the Shire. These the Nazgul took, and then sent him on to Bree to continue spying, but warned him that he was now in the service of Mordor, and that if ever he tried to return to Isengard, they would slay him with torture. Night was waning on the 22nd day of September, when drawing together again they came to Sarn Ford and the southernmost borders of the Shire. They found them guarded, for the rangers barred their way. But this was a task beyond the power of the Dunedain, and maybe it would still have proved so, even if their captain, Aragorn, had been with them. But he was away to the north, upon the east road, near Bree, and the hearts even of the Dunedain misgave them. Some fled northward, hoping to bear news to Aragorn, but they were pursued and slain, or driven away into the wild. Some still dared to bar the ford, and held it while day lasted, but at night the Lord of Morgul swept them away, and the Black Riders passed into the Shire. And ere the cocks crowed in the small hours of the 23rd day of September, some were riding north through the land, even as Gandalf, upon Shadowfax, was riding over Rohan, far behind. 2. Other versions of the story. Editor. I have chosen to give the version printed above as being the most finished as a narrative, but there is much other writing that bears on these events, adding to or modifying the story in important particulars. These manuscripts are confusing and their relations obscure, though they all doubtless derive from the same period. And it is sufficient to note the existence of two other primary accounts beside the one printed. Here, called for convenience, A. A second version, B, agrees very largely with A in its narrative structure. But a third, C, in the form of a plot outline beginning at a later point in the story, introduces some substantial differences. And this, I am inclined to think, is the latest in order of composition. In addition, there is some material, D, more particularly concerned with Gollum's part in the events, and various other notes bearing on this part of the history. In D, it is said that what Gollum revealed to Sauron of the ring and the place of its finding was sufficient to warn Sauron that this was indeed the One, but that of its present whereabouts he could only discover that it was stolen by a creature named Baggins in the Misty Mountains, and that Baggins came from a land called Shire. Sauron's fears were much allayed when he perceived from Gollum's account that Baggins must have been a creature of the same sort. Author: Gollum would not know the term hobbit, which was local and not a universal Westron word. He would probably not use halfling, since he was one himself, and hobbits disliked the name. That is why the Black Riders seem to have had two main pieces of information only to go on: Shire and Baggins. Editor: From all the accounts, it is clear that Gollum did at least know in which direction the Shire lay. But though no doubt more could have been wrung from him by torture, Sauron plainly had no inkling that Baggins came from a region far removed from the Misty Mountains, or that Gollum knew where it was, and assumed that he would be found in the Vales of Anduin, in the same region as Gollum himself had once lived. Author: This was a very small and natural error, but possibly the most important mistake that Sauron made in the whole affair. But for it, the Black Riders would have reached the Shire weeks sooner. Editor: In the text B, more is told of the journey of Aragorn with the captive Gollum northwards to the realm of Thranduil, and more consideration is given to Sauron's doubts about the use of the Ringwraiths in the search for the Ring. Author: After his release from Mordor, Gollum soon disappeared into the Dead Marshes, where Sauron's emissaries could not or would not follow him. No other spies of Sauron could bring him any news. Sauron probably had very little power yet in Eriador, and few agents there, and such as he sent were often hindered or misled by the servants of Saruman. At length, therefore, he resolved to use the Ringwraiths. He had been reluctant to do so until he knew precisely where the Ring was, for several reasons. They were by far the most powerful of his servants, and the most suitable for such a mission, since they were entirely enslaved to their 9 rings, which he now himself held. They were quite incapable of acting against his will, and if one of them, even the Witch King, their captain, had seized the One Ring, he would have brought it back to his master. But they had disadvantages, until open war began, for which Sauron was not yet ready. All except the Witch King were apt to stray when alone by daylight, and all again save the Witch King feared water and were unwilling, except in dire need, to enter it or to cross streams unless dry-shod by a bridge. Note 3. At the ford of Bruinen, only the Witch King and 2 others with the lure of the Ring straight before them had dared to enter the river. The others were driven into it by Glorfindel and Aragorn. Author's note. End of note. Moreover, their chief weapon was terror. This was actually greater when they were unclad and invisible, and it was greater also when they were gathered together. So any mission on which they were sent could hardly be conducted with secrecy, while the passage of Anduin and other rivers presented an obstacle. For such reasons, Sauron long hesitated, since he did not desire that his chief enemies should become aware of his servant's errand. It must be supposed that Sauron did not know at first that anyone save Gollum and the thief Baggins had any knowledge of the Ring. Until Gandalf came and questioned him, Gollum did not know that Gandalf had any connection with Bilbo. He had not even known of Gandalf's existence. Note 4. Gandalf, as he recounted to the Council of Elrond, questioned Gollum while he was imprisoned by the elves of Thranduil. End of note. But when Sauron learned of Gollum's capture by his enemies, the situation was drastically changed. When and how this happened cannot, of course, be known for certain, probably long after the event. According to Aragorn, Gollum was taken at nightfall on February 1st. Hoping to escape detection by any of Sauron's spies, he drove Gollum through the north end of the Emon Mule and crossed Anduin just above Sarn Gebir. Driftwood was often cast up there on the shoals by the east shore, and binding Gollum to a log, he swam across with him and continued his journey north by tracks as westerly as he could find, through the skirts of Fangorn, and so over Limlight, then over Nimrodel and Silverlode, through the eaves of Lorien, and then on, avoiding Moria and Dimrildale, over Gladden, until he came near the Kerak. Note 5. Gandalf told the Council of Elrond that after he left Minas Tirith, messages came to me out of Lorien that Aragorn had passed that way, and that he had found the creature called Gollum. End of note. There he crossed Anduin again, with the help of the Beornings, and passed into the forest. The whole journey, on foot, was not much short of 900 miles, and this Aragorn accomplished with weariness in 50 days, reaching Thranduil on the 21st of March. Note 6. Gandalf arrived 2 days later, and left on the 29th of March early in the morning. After the Kerok, he had a horse, but he had the high pass over the mountains to cross. He got a fresh horse at Rivendell, and making the greatest speed he could, he reached Hobbiton late on the 12th of April, after a journey of nearly 800 miles. Author's note. End of note. It is thus most likely that the first news of Gollum would be learned by the servants of Dol Guldur after Aragorn entered the forest. For though the power of Dol Guldur was supposed to come to an end at the old forest road, its spies were many in the wood. The news evidently did not reach the Nazgul commander of Dol Guldur for some time, and he probably did not inform Barad Dur until he had tried to learn more of Gollum's whereabouts. It would then no doubt be late in April before Sauron heard that Gollum had been seen again, apparently captive in the hands of a man. This might mean little. Neither Sauron nor any of his servants yet knew of Aragorn, or who he was. But evidently later, since the lands of Thranduil would now be closely watched, possibly a month later, Sauron heard the disquieting news that the wise were aware of Gollum, and that Gandalf had passed into Thranduil's realm. Sauron must then have been filled with anger and alarm. He resolved to use the Ringwraiths as soon as he could, for speed, rather than secrecy, was now important. Hoping to alarm his enemies and disturb their councils with the fear of war, which he did not intend to make for some time, he attacked Thranduil and Gondor at about the same time. Note 7. Both here and in the Tale of Years, the assault on Osgiliath is dated the 20th of June. End of note. He had these two additional objects: to capture or kill Gollum, or at least to deprive his enemies of him, and to force the passage of the Bridge of Osgiliath so that the Nazgul could cross while testing the strength of Gondor. In the event, Gollum escaped, but the passage of the bridge was effected. The forces there used were probably much less than men in Gondor thought. In the panic of the first assault, when the Witch King was allowed to reveal himself briefly in his full terror, the Nazgul crossed the bridge at night and dispersed northwards. Note 8. This statement no doubt relates to Boromir's account of the battle at Osgiliath, which he gave to the Council of Elrond. A power was there that we have not felt before. Some said that it could be seen like a great black horseman, a dark shadow under the moon. End of note. Without belittling the valor of Gondor, which indeed Sauron found greater far than he had hoped, it is clear that Boromir and Faramir were able to drive back the enemy and destroy the bridge, only because the attack had now served its main purpose. Editor, my father nowhere explained the Ringwraith's fear of water. In the account just cited, it is made a chief motive in Sauron's assault on Osgiliath, and it reappears in detailed notes on the movements of the Black Riders in the Shire. Thus, of the Rider, who was in fact Camul of Dol Guldur, see note 1, seen on the far side of Buckleberry Ferry just after the hobbits had crossed, the Fellowship of the Ring, 1-5, it is said that he was well aware that the ring had crossed the river, but the river was a barrier to his sense of its movement, and that the Nazgul would not touch the elvish waters of Barandwin. But it is not made clear how they crossed other rivers that lay in their path, such as the Greyflood, where there was only a dangerous ford formed by the ruins of the bridge. Page 264. My father did indeed note that the idea was difficult to sustain. The account of the vain journey of the Nazgul up the vales of Anduin is much the same in version B as in that printed in full above, A. But with the difference that in B, the Stour settlements were not entirely deserted at that time, and such of the Stours as dwelt there were slain or driven away by the Nazgul. Note 9. In a letter written in 1959, my father said, between 2463, when Deagle the store found the One Ring according to the tale of years, and the beginning of Gandalf's special inquiries concerning the ring, nearly 500 years later, they, the stores, appear indeed to have died out altogether, except, of course, for Smeagol, or to have fled from the shadow of Dol Guldur. End of note. In all the texts, the precise dates are slightly at variance both with each other and with those given in the Tale of Years. These differences are here neglected. In Dee is found an account of how Gollum fared after his escape from the orcs of Dol Guldur and before the Fellowship entered the West Gate of Moria. This is in a rough state and has required some slight editorial revision. Author. It seems clear that pursued both by elves and orcs, Gollum crossed the Anduin, probably by swimming, and so eluded the hunt of Sauron. But being still hunted by elves, and not yet daring to pass near Lorien, only the lure of the ring itself made him dare to do this afterwards, he hid himself in Moria. Note 10. According to the author's note given in Note 2 above, Gollum fled into Moria from terror of the Nazgûl. Compare also the suggestion on page 339 that one of the purposes of the Lord of Morgul in riding on northward beyond the Glatten was the hope of finding Gollum. End of note. That was probably in the autumn of the year, after which all trace of him was lost. What then happened to Gollum cannot, of course, be known for certain. He was peculiarly fitted to survive in such straits, though at cost of great misery. But he was in great peril of discovery by the servants of Sauron that lurked in Moria, especially since such bare necessity of food as he must have he could only get by thieving dangerously. Note 11. These were in fact not very numerous, it would seem, but sufficient to keep any intruders out, if no better armed or prepared than Balin's company, and not in great numbers. Author's note. End of note. No doubt he had intended to use Moria simply as a secret passage westward, his purpose being to find Shire himself as quickly as he could. But he became lost, and it was a very long time before he found his way about. It thus seems probable that he had not long made his way towards the West Gate when the Nine Walkers arrived. He knew nothing, of course, about the action of the doors. To him they would seem huge and immovable, and though they had no lock or bar and opened outwards to a thrust, he did not discover that. In any case, he was now far away from any source of food, for the orcs were mostly in the east end of Moria, and was become weak and desperate, so that even if he had known all about the doors, he still could not have thrust them open. Note 12. According to the dwarves, this needed usually the thrust of two. Only a very strong dwarf could open them single-handed. Before the desertion of Moria, door wards were kept inside the west gate, and one at least was always there. In this way, a single person, and so any intruder or person trying to escape, could not get out without permission. Author's note. End of note. It was thus a piece of singular good fortune for Gollum that the Nine Walkers arrived when they did. Editor. The story of the coming of the Black Riders to Isengard in September 3018 and their subsequent capture of Grima Wormtongue, as told in A and B, is much altered in version C, which takes up the narrative only at their return southward over the Limelight. In A and B, it was 2 days after Gandalf's escape from Orthanc that the Nazgûl came to Isengard. Saruman told them that Gandalf was gone and denied all knowledge of the Shire, but was betrayed by Grima, whom they captured on the following day, as he hastened to Isengard with news of Gandalf's coming to Edoras. Note 13. In A, Saruman denied knowledge of where the ring was hid. In B, he denied all knowledge of the land that they sought, but this is probably no more than a difference of wording. End of note. In C, on the other hand, the Black Riders arrived at the gate of Isengard while Gandalf was still a prisoner in the tower. In this account, Saruman, in fear and despair, and perceiving the full horror of service to Mordor, resolved suddenly to yield to Gandalf and to beg for his pardon and help. Temporizing at the gate, he admitted that he had Gandalf within, and said that he would go and try to discover what he knew. If that were unavailing, he would deliver Gandalf up to them. Then Saruman hastened to the summit of Orthonk, and found Gandalf gone. Away south, against the setting moon, he saw a great eagle flying towards Edoras. Now Saruman's case was worse. If Gandalf had escaped, there was still a real chance that Sauron would not get the ring, and would be defeated. In his heart, Saruman recognized the great power and the strange good fortune that went with Gandalf. But now he was left alone to deal with the Nine. His mood changed, and his pride reasserted itself in anger at Gandalf's escape from impenetrable Isengard. And in a fury of jealousy, he went back to the gate, and he lied, saying that he had made Gandalf confess. He did not admit that this was his own knowledge, not being aware of how much Sauron knew of his mind and heart. Note 14. Earlier in this version, it is said that Sauron had at this time, by means of the Palantiri, at last begun to daunt Saruman, and could, in any case, often read his thought, even when he withheld information. Thus, Sauron was aware that Saruman had some guess at the place where the ring was, and Saruman actually revealed that he had got as his prisoner Gandalf, who knew the most. End of note.
"I will report this myself to the Lord of Barad-dûr," he said loftily, "to whom I speak from afar on great matters that concern us. But all that you need to know on the mission that he has given you is where the Shire lies."
"That," says Mithrandir, "is northwest from here, some 600 miles, on the borders of the seaward Elvish country." To his pleasure, Saruman saw that even the Witch King did not relish that.
"You must cross Isen by the fords, and then rounding the mountain's end, make for Tharbad upon Greyflood. Go with speed, and I will report to your master that you have done so."
This skillful speech convinced even the Witch King for the moment that Saruman was a faithful ally, high in Sauron's confidence. At once the riders left the gate and rode in haste to the fords of Isen. Behind them Saruman sent out wolves and orcs in vain pursuit of Gandalf. But in this he had other purposes also, to impress his power upon the Nazgûl, perhaps also to prevent them from lingering near, and in his anger he wished to do some injury to Rohan and to increase the fear of him which his agent Wormtongue was building up in Théoden's heart. Wormtongue had been in Isengard not long since, and was then on his way back to Edoras. Among the pursuers were some bearing messages to him. When he was rid of the riders, Saruman retired to Orthonk, and sat in earnest and dreadful thought. It seems that he resolved still to temporize, and still to hope to get the ring for himself. He thought that the direction of the riders to the Shire might hinder them rather than help them, for he knew of the guard of the rangers, and he believed also, knowing of the oracular dream words and of Boromir's mission, that the ring had gone and was already on the way to Rivendell. At once he marshaled and sent out into Eriador all the spies, spybirds, and agents that he could muster. In this version, the element of Grima's capture by the ringwraiths and his betrayal of Saruman is thus absent. For, of course, there is insufficient time by this account for Gandalf to reach Edoras and attempt to warn King Théoden, and for Grima, in his turn, to set out for Isengard to warn Saruman before the Black Riders were already gone from Rohan. Note 15. The entry for the 18th of September 3018 in the Tale of Years reads, "Gandalf escapes from Orthonk in the early hours. The Black Riders cross the fords of Isen." Laconic as this entry is, giving no hint that the riders visited Isengard, it seems to be based on the story told in version C. End of note. The revelation of Saruman's lying to them here comes about through the man whom they captured and found to be bearing maps of the Shire, page 341, and more is told of this man and of Saruman's dealings with the Shire. When the Black Riders were far across Enedwaith, and drawing near at last to Tharbad, They had what was for them a great stroke of good fortune, but disastrous for Saruman and deadly perilous for Frodo. Note 16. No indication is given in any of these texts of what passed between Sauron and Saruman as a result of the latter's unmasking. End of note. Saruman had long taken an interest in the Shire, because Gandalf did, and he was suspicious of him, and because, again in secret imitation of Gandalf, he had taken to the halfling's leaf and needed supplies. But in pride, having once scoffed at Gandalf's use of the weed, kept this as secret as he could. Latterly, other motives were added. He liked to extend his power, especially into Gandalf's province, and he found that the money he could provide for the purchase of leaf was giving him power, and was corrupting some of the hobbits, especially the Bracegirdles, who owned many plantations, and so also the Sackville Bagginses. Note 17. Lobelia Bracegirdle married Otho Sackville Baggins. Their son was Lotho, who seized control of the Shire at the time of the War of the Ring, and was then known as the Chief. Farmer Cotton referred in conversation with Frodo to Lotho's property in leaf plantations in the South Farthing. The Return of the King, 6-8. End of note. But also, he had begun to feel certain that in some way the Shire was connected with the Ring in Gandalf's mind. Why this strong guard upon it? He therefore began to collect detailed information about the Shire, its chief persons and families, its roads, and other matters. For this he used hobbits within the Shire, in the pay of the Bracegirdles and the Sackville Bagginses, but his agents were men of Dunlendish origin. When Gandalf had refused to treat with him, Saruman had redoubled his efforts. The rangers were suspicious, but did not actually refuse entry to the servants of Saruman, for Gandalf was not at liberty to warn them, and when he had gone off to Isengard, Saruman was still recognized as an ally. Some while ago, one of Saruman's most trusted servants, yet a ruffianly fellow, an outlaw driven from Dunland, where many said that he had orc blood, had returned from the borders of the Shire, where he had been negotiating for the purchase of leaf and other supplies. Saruman was beginning to store Isengard against war. This man was now on his way back to continue the business and to arrange for the transport of many goods before autumn failed. Note 18. The usual way was by the crossing of Tharbad to Dunland, rather than direct to Isengard, whence goods were sent more secretly on to Saruman. Author's note. End of note. He had orders also to get into the Shire if possible, and learn if there had been any departures of persons well known recently. He was well supplied with maps, lists of names, and notes concerning the Shire. This Dunlending was overtaken by several of the Black Riders as they approached the Tharbad crossing. In an extremity of terror, he was hailed to the Witch King and questioned. He saved his life by betraying Saruman. The Witch King thus learned that Saruman knew well all along where the Shire was, and knew much about it, which he could and should have told to Sauron's servants, if he had been a true ally. The Witch King also obtained much information, including some about the only name that interested him, Baggins. It was for this reason that Hobbiton was singled out as one of the points for immediate visit and inquiry. The Witch King had now a clearer understanding of the matter. He had known something of the country long ago, in his wars with the Dúnedain, and especially of the Turn Gorthod of Cardolan, now the Barrow Downs, whose evil wights had been sent there by himself. Note 19. Compare The Lord of the Rings, Appendix A, 1-3, The North Kingdom and the Dúnedain. It was at this time, during the great plague that reached Gondor in 1636, that an end came of the Dúnedain of Cardolan, and evil spirits out of Angmar and Rudaur entered into the deserted mounds and dwelt there. End of note. Seeing that his master suspected some move between the Shire and Rivendell, he also saw that Bree, the position of which he knew, would be an important point, at least for information. Note 20. Since the Black Captain knew so much, it is perhaps strange that he had had so little idea of where the Shire, the land of the halflings, lay, According to the tale of years, there were already hobbits settled in Bree at the beginning of the 14th century of the Third Age, when the Witch King came north to Angmar. End of note. He put, therefore, the shadow of fear on the Dunlending and sent him on to Bree as an agent. He was the squint-eyed southerner at the inn. Note 21. See the Fellowship of the Ring, 1-9, when Strider and the hobbits left Bree. Ibid, 1-2. Frodo caught a glimpse of the Dunlending, a sallow face with sly slanting eyes, in Bill Fairney's house on the outskirts of Bree, and thought, he looks more than half like a goblin. End of note. In version B, it is noted that the Black Captain did not know whether the ring was still in the Shire. That he had to find out. The Shire was too large for a violent onslaught, such as he had made on the stores. He must use as much stealth and as little terror as he could, and yet also guard the eastern borders. Therefore he sent some of the riders into the Shire, with orders to disperse while traversing it, and of these Camul was to find Hobbiton. See note 1, where Baggins lived, according to Saruman's papers. But the Black Captain established a camp at Ondroth, where the Greenway passed in a defile between the Barrow Downs and the South Downs, and from there some others were sent to watch and patrol the eastern borders, while he himself visited the Barrow Downs. Note 22. Compare Gandalf's words at the Council of Elrond. Their captain remained in secret away south of Bree. End of note. In notes on the movements of the Black Riders at that time, it is said that the Black Captain stayed there for some days, and the Barrow-wights were roused, and all things of evil spirit, hostile to elves and men, were on the watch with malice in the old forest and on the Barrow Downs. 3. Concerning Gandalf, Saruman, and the Shire. Another set of papers from the same period consists of a large number of unfinished accounts of Saruman's earlier dealings with the Shire, especially as they concerned the Halfling's Leaf, a matter that is touched on in connection with the squint-eyed southerner. See pages 347 and 348. The following text is one version among many, but though briefer than some, is the most finished. Author. Saruman soon became jealous of Gandalf, and this rivalry turned at last to a hatred, the deeper for being concealed, and the more bitter in that Saruman knew in his heart that the Grey Wanderer had the greater strength, and the greater influence upon the dwellers in Middle-earth, even though he hid his power and desired neither fear nor reverence. Saruman did not revere him, but he grew to fear him, being ever uncertain how much Gandalf perceived of his inner mind, troubled more by his silences than by his words. So it was that openly he treated Gandalf with less respect than did others of the wise, and was ever ready to gainsay him, or to make little of his counsels, while secretly he noted and pondered all that he said, setting a watch, so far as he was able, upon all his movements. It was in this way that Saruman came to give thought to the Halflings and the Shire, which otherwise he would have deemed beneath his notice. He had at first no thought that the interest of his rival in this people had any connection with the great concerns of the Council, least of all with the Rings of Power. For indeed, in the beginning, it had no such connection, and was due only to Gandalf's love for the little people, unless his heart had some deep premonition beyond his waking thought. For many years he visited the Shire openly, and would speak of its people to any who would listen, and Saruman would smile, as at the idle tales of an old Land Rover, but he took heed, nonetheless. Seeing then that Gandalf thought the Shire worth visiting, Saruman himself visited it, but disguised, and in the utmost secrecy, until he had explored and noted all its ways and lands, and thought then he had learned all that there was to know of it. And even when it seemed to him no longer wise nor profitable to go thither, he still had spies and servants that went in or kept an eye upon its borders, for he was still suspicious. He was himself so far fallen that he believed all others of the council had each their deep and far-reaching policies for their own enhancement, to which all that they did must in some way refer. So when long after he learned something of the finding of Gollum's ring by the Halfling, he could believe only that Gandalf had known of this all the time, and this was his greatest grievance, since all that concerned the rings he deemed his especial province. That Gandalf's mistrust of him was merited and just in no way lessened his anger. Yet in truth, Saruman's spying in great secrecy had not in the beginning any evil purpose, but was no more than a folly born of pride. Small matters, unworthy it would seem to be reported, may yet prove of great moment ere the end. Now truth to tell, observing Gandalf's love of the herb that he called pipeweed, for which he said, if for nothing else, the little people should be honored, Saruman had affected to scoff at it, but in private he made trial of it, and soon began to use it. And for this reason the Shire remained important to him. Yet he dreaded lest this should be discovered, and his own mockery turned against him, so that he would be laughed at for imitating Gandalf, and scorned for doing so by stealth. This, then, was the reason for his great secrecy in all his dealings with the Shire, even from the first, before any shadow of doubt had fallen upon it, and it was little guarded, free for those who wished to enter. For this reason also Saruman ceased to go thither in person, for it came to his knowledge that he had not been all unobserved by the keen-eyed halflings, and some, seeing the figure, as it were, of an old man clad in gray or russet, stealing through the woods or passing through the dusk, had mistaken him for Gandalf. After that, Saruman went no more to the Shire, fearing that such tales might spread and come maybe to the ears of Gandalf. But Gandalf knew of these visits and guessed their object, and he laughed, thinking this the most harmless of Saruman's secrets. But he said nothing to others, for it was never his wish that anyone should be put to shame. Nonetheless, he was not ill-pleased when the visits of Saruman ceased, doubting him already, though he could not himself yet foresee that a time would come when Saruman's knowledge of the Shire would prove perilous and of the greatest service to the enemy, bringing victory to within a nail's breadth of his grasp. Editor, in another version, there is a description of the occasion when Saruman openly scoffed at Gandalf's use of the pipeweed. Author, now because of his dislike and fear, in the later days Saruman avoided Gandalf, and they seldom met, except at the assemblies of the White Council. It was at the Great Council held in 2851 that the halfling's leaf was first spoken of, and the matter was noted with amusement at the time, though it was afterwards remembered in a different light. The council met in Rivendell, and Gandalf sat apart, silent, but smoking prodigiously, a thing he had never done before on such an occasion, while Saruman spoke against him, and urged that contrary to Gandalf's advice, Dol Guldur should not yet be molested. Both the silence and the smoke seemed greatly to annoy Saruman, and before the council dispersed, he said to Gandalf, "When weighty matters are in debate, Mithron dear, I wonder a little that you should play with your toys of fire and smoke while others are in earnest speech." But Gandalf laughed and replied, "You would not wonder if you used this herb yourself. You might find that smoke blown out cleared your mind of shadows within. Anyway, it gives patience to listen to error without anger. But it is not one of my toys. It is an art of the little people away in the West, merry and worthy folk, though not of much account, perhaps, in your high policies." Saruman was little appeased by this answer, for he hated mockery, however gentle. And he said then coldly, "You jest, Lord Mithrandir, as is your way. I know well enough that you have become a curious explorer of the small, weeds, wild things, and childish folk. Your time is your own to spend if you have nothing worthier to do, and your friends you may make as you please. But to me the days are too dark for wanderers' tales, and I have no time for the simples of peasants." Gandalf did not laugh again, and he did not answer, but looking keenly at Saruman, he drew on his pipe and sent out a great ring of smoke with many smaller rings that followed it. Then he put up his hand as if to grasp them, and they vanished. With that, he got up and left Saruman, without another word. But Saruman stood for some time silent, and his face was dark with doubt and displeasure. Editor, this story appears in half a dozen different manuscripts, and in one of them it is said that Saruman was suspicious. Arthur, doubting whether he read rightly the purport of Gandalf's gesture with the rings of smoke, above all whether it showed any connection between the halflings and the great matter of the rings of power, unlikely though that might seem, and doubting that one so great could concern himself with such a people as the halflings for their own sake merely. Editor, in another, struck through, Gandalf's purpose is made explicit. Author, it was a strange chance that, being angered by his insolence, Gandalf chose this way of showing to Saruman his suspicion that desire to possess them had begun to enter into his policies and his study of the lore of the rings, and of warning him that they would elude him. For it cannot be doubted that Gandalf had as yet no thought that the halflings, and still less their smoking, had any connection with the rings. Note 23. As the concluding sentence of this quotation shows, the meaning is, Gandalf had as yet no thought that the halflings would have in the future any connection with the rings. The meeting of the White Council in 2851 took place 90 years before Bilbo found the ring. End of note. If he had had any such thought, then certainly he would not have done then what he did. Yet later, when the halflings did indeed become involved in this greatest matter, Saruman could believe only that Gandalf had known or foreknown this, and had concealed the knowledge from him and from the council, for just such a purpose as Saruman would conceive, to gain possession and to forestall him. Editor, in the Tale of Years, the entry for 2851 refers to the meeting of the White Council in that year when Gandalf urged an attack on Dol Guldur, but was overruled by Saruman, and a footnote to the entry reads, it afterwards became clear that Saruman had then begun to desire to possess the One Ring himself, and hoped that it might reveal itself, seeking its master, if Sauron were let be for a time. The foregoing story shows that Gandalf himself suspected Saruman of this at the time of the Council of 2851. Though my father afterwards commented that it appears from Gandalf's story to the Council of Elrond, of his meeting with Radagast, that he did not seriously suspect Saruman of treachery, or of desiring the ring for himself, until he was imprisoned in Orthanc. 5. The Battles of the Fords of Isen. Author. The chief obstacles to any easy conquest of Rohan by Saruman were Theodred and Éomer. They were vigorous men, devoted to the king, and high in his affections, as his only son and his sister son, and they did all that they could to thwart the influence over him that Grima gained when the king's health began to fail. This occurred early in the year 3014, when Theoden was 66. His malady may thus have been due to natural causes, though the Rohirrim commonly lived till near or beyond their 80th year. But it may well have been induced or increased by subtle poisons administered by Grima. In any case, Theoden's sense of weakness and dependence on Grima was largely due to the cunning and skill of this evil counselor's suggestions. It was his policy to bring his chief opponents into discredit with Theoden, and if possible, to get rid of them. It proved impossible to set them at odds with one another. Theoden, before his sickness, had been much loved by all his kin and people, and the loyalty of Theodred and Éomer remained steadfast, even in his apparent dotage. Éomer also was not an ambitious man, and his love and respect for Theodred, 13 years older than he, was only second to his love of his foster father. Note 1. Éomer was the son of Théoden's sister, Théodwyn, and of Éomund of Eastfold, chief marshal of the Mark. Éomund was slain by orcs in 3002, and Théodwyn died soon after. Their children, Éomer and Éowyn, were then taken to live in King Théoden's house, together with Théodred, the king's only child. The Lord of the Rings, Appendix A, 2. End of note. Grima therefore tried to play them one against the other in the mind of Théoden, representing Éomer as ever eager to increase his own authority and to act without consulting the king or his heir. In this he had some success, which bore fruit when Saruman at last succeeded in achieving the death of Théodred. It was clearly seen in Rohan, when the true accounts of the battles at the fords were known, that Saruman had given special orders that Théodred should at all costs be slain. At the first battle, all his fiercest warriors were engaged in reckless assaults upon Théodred and his guard, disregarding other events of the battle, which might otherwise have resulted in a much more damaging defeat for the Rohirrim. When Théodred was at last slain, Saruman's commander, no doubt under orders, seemed satisfied for the time being, and Saruman made the mistake, fatal as it proved, of not immediately throwing in more forces and proceeding at once to a massive invasion of Westfold, though the valor of Grimbald and Elfhelm contributed to his delay. Note 2. The Ents are here left out of account, as they were by all save Gandalf. But unless Gandalf could have brought about the rising of the Ents several days earlier, as from the narrative was plainly not possible, it would not have saved Rohan. The Ents might have destroyed Isengard and even captured Saruman, if after victory he had not himself followed his army. The Ents and Huorns, with the aid of such riders of the Eastmark as had not yet been engaged, might have destroyed the forces of Saruman in Rohan, but the Mark would have been in ruins and leaderless. Even if the Red Arrow had found anyone with authority to receive it, the call from Gondor would not have been heeded, or at most a few companies of weary men would have reached Minas Tirith, too late except to perish with it. Author's note. For the Red Arrow, see The Return of the King, 1-3, where it was brought to Théoden by an errand rider from Gondor as a token of the need of Minas Tirith. End of note. If the invasion of Westfold had begun 5 days earlier, there can be little doubt that the reinforcements from Edoras would never have come near Helm's Deep, but would have been surrounded and overwhelmed in the open plain. If indeed Edoras had not itself been attacked and captured before the arrival of Gandalf. Note 3. The first battle of the Fords of Isen, in which Théodred was slain, was fought on the 25th of February. Gandalf reached Edoras 7 days later, on the 2nd of March. The Lord of the Rings, Appendix B, Year 3019. See Note 7. End of note. It has been said that the valor of Grimbald and Elfhelm contributed to Saruman's delay, which proved disastrous for him. The above account perhaps underestimates its importance. The Isen came down swiftly from its sources above Isengard, but in the flat land of the Gap it became slow until it turned west. Then it flowed on through country falling by long slopes down into the low-lying coastlands of Firthis Gondor and the Enedwaith, and it became deep and rapid. Just above this westward bend were the fords of Isen. There the river was broad and shallow, passing in two arms about a large eyot, over a stony shelf covered with stones and pebbles brought down from the north. Only here, south of Isengard, was it possible for large forces, especially those heavily armed or mounted, to cross the river. Saruman thus had this advantage. He could send his troops down either side of the Isen and attack the fords, if they were held against him, from both sides. Any force of his west of Isen could, if necessary, retreat upon Isengard. On the other hand, Théodred might send men across the fords, either in sufficient strength to engage Saruman's troops, or to defend the western bridgehead. But if they were worsted, they would have no retreat, except back over the fords, with the enemy at their heels, and possibly also awaiting them on the eastern bank. South and west along the Isen they had no way home, unless they were provisioned for a long journey into western Gondor. Note 4. Beyond the Gap, the land between Isen and Adorn was nominally part of the realm of Rohan. But though Fólkwynna had reclaimed it, driving out the Dunlendings that had occupied it, the people that remained were largely of mixed blood, and their loyalty to Edoras was weak. The slaying of their lord, Freca, by King Helm, was still remembered. Indeed, at this time, they were more disposed to side with Saruman, and many of their warriors had joined Saruman's forces. In any case, there was no way into their land from the west, except for bold swimmers. Author's note. The region between Isen and Adorn was declared to be a part of the realm of Eorl at the time of the Oath of Cirion and Eorl. See page 305. In the year 2754, Helm Hammerhand, King of the Mark, slew with his fist his arrogant vassal Freka, lord of lands on either side of the Adorn. See The Lord of the Rings, Appendix A, 2. End of note. Saruman's attack was not unforeseen, but it came sooner than was expected. Theodred's scouts had warned him of a mustering of troops before the gates of Isengard, mainly, as it seemed, on the west side of Isen. He therefore manned the approaches, east and west, to the fords with sturdy men on foot from the levies of Westfold. Leaving three companies of riders, together with horse herds and spare mounts on the east bank, he himself passed over with the main strength of his cavalry. 8 companies and a company of archers, intending to overthrow Saruman's army before it was fully prepared. But Saruman had not revealed his intentions, nor the full strength of his forces. They were already on the march when Theodred set out. Some 20 miles north of the fords, he encountered their vanguard and scattered it with loss. But when he rode on to attack the main host, the resistance stiffened. The enemy was in fact in positions prepared for the event, behind trenches manned by pikemen. And Theodred, in the leading Eared, was brought to a stand and almost surrounded, for new forces hastening from Isengard were now outflanking him upon the west. He was extricated by the onset of the companies coming up behind him, but as he looked eastward, he was dismayed. It had been a dim and misty morning, but the mists were now rolling back through the gap on a breeze from the west, and away east of the river he descried other forces now hasting towards the fords, though their strength could not be guessed. He at once ordered a retreat. This the riders, well trained in the maneuver, managed in good order and with little further loss. But the enemy was not shaken off or long outdistanced, for the retreat was often delayed. When the rear guard under Grimbald was obliged to turn at bay and drive back the most eager of their pursuers. When Theodred gained the ford, the day was waning. He set Grimbald in command of the garrison of the west bank, stiffened with 50 dismounted riders. The rest of his riders and all the horses he at once sent across the river, save his own company. With these on foot, he manned the Eyot to cover the retreat of Grimbald if he was driven back. This was barely done when disaster came. Saruman's eastern force came down with unexpected speed. It was much smaller than the western force, but more dangerous. In its van were some Dunlending horsemen, and a great pack of the dreadful orcish wolf riders, feared by horses. Note 5. They were very swift and skilled in avoiding ordered men in close array, being used mostly to destroy isolated groups or to hunt down fugitives. But at need they would pass with reckless ferocity through any gaps in companies of horsemen, slashing at the bellies of the horses. Author's note. End of note. Behind them came 2 battalions of the fierce Uruks, heavily armed but trained to move at great speed for many miles. The horsemen and wolf riders fell on the horse herds and picketed horses and slew or dispersed them. The garrison of the east bank, surprised by the sudden assault of the massed Uruks, was swept away, and the riders that had just crossed from the west were caught still in disarray, and though they fought desperately, they were driven from the fords along the line of the Isen with the Uruks in pursuit. As soon as the enemy had gained possession of the eastern end of the fords, there appeared a company of men, or orc men, evidently dispatched for the purpose. Ferocious, mail-clad, and armed with axes, they hastened to the Eyot and assailed it from both sides. At the same time, Grimbald on the west bank was attacked by Saruman's forces on that side of the Isen. As he looked eastward, dismayed by the sounds of battle and the hideous orc cries of victory, he saw the axemen driving Theodred's men from the shores of the Eyot towards the low knoll in its center, and he heard Theodred's great voice crying,
"To me, Eorlingas!"
At once, Grimbald, taking a few men that stood near him, ran back to the Eyot. So fierce was his onset from the rear of the attackers that Grimbald, a man of great strength and stature, clove his way through, till with 2 others he reached Theodred, standing at bay on the knoll. Too late. As he came to his side, Theodred fell, hewn down by a great orc man. Grimbald slew him and stood over the body of Theodred, thinking him dead, and there he would himself soon have died, but for the coming of Elfhelm. Elfhelm had been riding in haste along the horse road from Edoras, leading 4 companies in answer to Theodred's summons. He was expecting battle, but not yet for some days. But near the junction of the horse road with the road down from the Deeping, his outriders on the right flank reported that 2 wolf riders had been seen abroad on the fields. Note 6. The Deeping. This is so written and is clearly correct, since it occurs again later. My father noted elsewhere that the Deeping-Coom and Deeping-Stream should be so spelt, rather than Deeping-Coom. Since Deeping is not a verbal ending but one indicating relationship, the coom or deep valley belonging to the deep, Helm's Deep, to which it led up. Notes on Nomenclature to Assist Translators, published in A Tolkien Compass, edited by Jared Lobdell, 1975, page 181. End of note. Sensing that things were amiss, he did not turn aside to Helm's Deep for the night, as he had intended, but rode with all speed towards the fords. The horse road turned northwest after its meeting with the Deeping Road, but again bent sharply west when level with the fords, which it approached by a straight path of some 2 miles long. Elfhelm thus heard and saw nothing of the fighting between the retreating garrison and the Uruks south of the fords. The sun had sunk, and light was failing when he drew near the last bend in the road, and there encountered some horses running wild, and a few fugitives who told him of the disaster. Though his men and horses were now weary, he rode as fast as he could along the strait, and as he came in sight of the east bank, he ordered his companies to charge. It was the turn of the Isengarders to be surprised. They heard the thunder of hooves, and saw coming like black shadows against the darkening east a great host, as it seemed, with Elfhelm at its head, and beside him a white standard, borne as a guide to those that followed. Few stood their ground. Most fled northwards, pursued by two of Elfhelm's companies. The others he dismounted to guard the east bank, but at once with the men of his own company rushed to the Eyot. The axemen were now caught between the surviving defenders and the onslaught of Elfhelm, with both banks still held by the Rohirrim. They fought on, but before the end were slain to a man. Elfhelm himself, however, sprang up towards the knoll, and there he found Grimbold fighting two great axemen for possession of Theodred's body. One Elfhelm at once slew, and the other fell before Grimbold. They stooped then to lift the body, and found that Theodred still breathed, but he lived only long enough to speak his last words.
"Let me lie here, to keep the fords till Éomer comes."
Night fell. A harsh horn sounded, and then all was silent. The attack on the west bank ceased, and the enemy there faded away into the dark. The Rohirrim held the fords of Isen, but their losses were heavy, not least in horses. The king's son was dead, and they were leaderless, and did not know what might yet befall. When after a cold and sleepless night the gray light returned, there was no sign of the Isengarders, save those many that they left dead upon the field. Wolves were howling far off, waiting for the living men to depart. Many men scattered by the sudden assault of the Isengarders began to return, some still mounted, some leading horses recaptured. Later in the morning, most of Theodred's riders that had been driven south down the river by a battalion of black Uruks came back battle-worn, but in good order. They had a like tale to tell. They came to a stand on a low hill and prepared to defend it. Though they had drawn off part of the attacking force of Isengard, retreat south unprovisioned was in the end hopeless. The Uruks had resisted any attempt to burst eastwards, and were driving them towards the now hostile country of the Dunlandish West March. But as the riders prepared to resist their assault, though it was now full night, a horn was sounded, and soon they discovered that the enemy had gone. They had too few horses to attempt any pursuit, or even to act as scouts, so far as that would have availed by night. After some time they began cautiously to advance north again, but met no opposition. They thought that the Uruks had gone back to reinforce their hold on the fords, and expected there to meet in battle again, and they wondered much to find the Rohirrim in command. It was not till later that they discovered whither the Uruks had gone. So ended the first battle of the fords of Isen. Of the second battle no such clear accounts were ever made, owing to the much greater events that immediately followed. Erkenbrand of Westfold assumed command of the West Mark, when news of the fall of Theodred reached him in the Hornburg on the next day. He sent Arid riders to Edoras to announce this, and to bear Theoden his son's last words, adding his own prayer that Éomer should be sent at once, with all help that could be spared. Note 7. The messages did not reach Edoras until about noon on February the 27th. Gandalf came there early in the morning of March the 2nd. February had 30 days. It was thus, as Grima said, not then fully 5 days since news of Theodred's death had reached the king. Author's note. The reference is to the Two Towers, 3-6. End of note.
Let the defense of Edoras be made here in the west, he said, and not wait till it is itself besieged.
But Grima used the curtness of this advice to further his policy of delay. It was not until his defeat by Gandalf that any action was taken. The reinforcements, with Éomer and the king himself, set out in the afternoon of March the 2nd. But that night, the second battle of the fords was fought and lost, and the invasion of Rohan began. Erkin Braun did not at once himself proceed to the battlefield. All was in confusion. He did not know what forces he could muster in haste, nor could he yet estimate the losses that Théodred's troops had actually suffered. He judged rightly that invasion was imminent, but that Saruman would not dare to pass on eastward to attack Edoras while the fortress of the Hornburg was unreduced, if it was manned and well stored. With this business and the gathering of such men of Westfold as he could, he was occupied for 3 days. The command in the field he gave to Grimbold until he could come himself, but he assumed no command over Elfhelm and his riders, who belonged to the muster of Edoras. The two commanders were, however, friends and both loyal and wise men, and there was no dissension between them. The ordering of their forces was a compromise between their differing opinions. Elfhelm held that the fords were no longer important, but rather a snare to entrap men better placed elsewhere, since Saruman could clearly send forces down either side of the Isen as suited his purpose, and his immediate purpose would undoubtedly be to overrun Westfold and invest the Hornburg before any effective help could come from Edoras. His army, or most of it, would therefore come down the east side of the Isen, for though by that way, over rougher ground without roads, their approach would be slower, they would not have to force the passage of the fords.